Our next speaker will be Alan Kanasky. Alan is a forest pathologist for the Oregon Department of Forestry in Salem, and he's worked more than 30 years in the western U.S., 25 of those with the Oregon Department of Forestry. And since Peter Morm, his primary focus has narrowed to cover sudden oak death in Oregon, and he'll be providing an update on movement of from eradication posture to one of containment.
Thanks, Don. The title for this was suggested by Susan Frankel. That was the first part of the title. I want to begin by acknowledging a lot of organizations and people involved are listed at the bottom of the first slide, but I especially want to acknowledge the U.S. Forest Service for various programs of that agency for their continued funding, without which we wouldn't be doing this in Oregon. The question about eradication, it's clear in Oregon that what we have been doing is eradication, and what we continue to do is eradication, and as I'll talk about in a little bit, there's really not too many choices. If we're going to do anything, it's basically an eradication activity. We're also operating under a state quarantine, and that quarantine clearly requires that when the disease is discovered on a property, it has to be eradicated. And we haven't changed that quarantine and moved out of that position. So here's our situation. It's this one little spot up near Brookings. It's been there for about 10 years. And I want to just remind you about the ecology in Oregon. Tan oak is the key species in Oregon. We don't have a situation in Oregon as you have in many parts of California where you have bay driving an infestation. We're getting infection in the canopy of tan oak. Spores are produced there, and they're being spread locally or long distances from that point. Tan oak's also the species that is readily killed. We have a lot of other species in Oregon that are host species. They are infected, but they're only infected when they're near infected tan oak, and they do not seem to be important at our current inoculum levels in disease spread. I'm going to go through the different elements of the Oregon program and just talk about some recent findings for each of those. Our early detection is based primarily on aerial survey. This is something that's coordinated by Mike McWilliams cooperatively with the U.S. Forest Service. At least four times a year, a combination of fixed wing and helicopter, and it focuses on finding dead tan oaks. So the yellow spots are dead tan oaks that are spotted from the air, and then each one of those spots is visited and the trees are checked for P. remorum. Now the survey is good, but it has some limitations. It's easy to pick up these red trees in a sea of green, a little harder to find these trees. And there's some question as to whether it's really early detection, because we can only pick up dead trees. So by the time they're dead, the pathogen has been present for some time. But it is early in the sense that all of our detections in the last couple of years have been single or pairs of trees. We don't find large patches of dead trees with an expanding infestation. We find them early. We get them when there's a single dead tree, and when we go to those sites on the ground, we may find one or two infected trees there, and that is it. We supplement the aerial survey now with more ground scouting. That we have two full-time staff in Brookings, so they're able to pick up symptoms on trees that you couldn't see from the air, and some of these other symptoms that are impossible to see from the air, such as lower crown discoloration of foliage. And this has greatly increased the early part of our detection program. We also do transect surveys. These are basically blind surveys. So these are areas that are identified for survey without the presence of a dead tree to lead us there. These are either areas where we've identified them as a high-risk area for disease spread, or they're places where a landowner wants to harvest tan oak and export it from the quarantine area. And in order to do that, they have to get a pest-free certification. And a survey, a ground survey, is one component of that certification. So typically, the surveyors are looking for bleeding on trunks of green trees or possibly foliar symptoms. And we rarely find anything using this method. We found some infected trees one time. But that's good news, because we've done a lot of these surveys away from our infested areas, and we're not finding infection in those places. Our last detection method is stream baiting, which you're all familiar with. We've got 58 active sites in Oregon. We've added a few recently down in this California border area. To date, we're only finding positives in this core area where we have most of the infested sites. We're not finding any positives in these other watersheds. So these are test cases here. They show that the method is working, and we're just not finding it out here. But there may be some limits to our ability to detect. So a large watershed like the Windchuck, not getting a positive down here at the Bay Station doesn't necessarily mean that the pathogen isn't present up here. Our data suggests, on average, we were getting detections about a kilometer away from our baits, and in some rare cases up to 4 kilometers away. So not very far, but we have very low levels of inoculum, and that may be part of that. When we do have an infestation, like this little patch of red trees, we go out and survey very intensively this area and then establish the perimeter of that treatment area. Right now our standard is 300 feet, but it ranges from 100 to 300 feet in terms of a radius. And then we hack and squirt the host plants on all lands except on Bureau of Land Management lands where they can't use herbicide yet. And then we cut and burn the tanoak and other host plants on those sites. Burn the piles or do a broadcast burn. We prefer the broadcast burn. This is all done at no cost to the landowners, thanks to federal funding, but there's also no compensation to landowners, and they have no choice in the matter. It's a matter of state quarantine. So we get various types of situations, a lot of large clear cuts, which we prefer if we can with the broadcast burn, but in many cases where tanoak is an understory species, we get understory removal, leaving an intact overstory of, in this case, Douglas fir, and in other cases, redwood. In some situations, we've gotten landowners to agree to kill tanoak. These are the infested sites that have been treated by cutting and burning. We kill the tanoak in these areas adjacent to them to take away the pathway of likely spread in the future. We don't do very much of this, but I think it's been helpful. Some of this gets pretty messy when you get each of these different colored polygons is a treatment area over the years. This is the Curry Hillside. So we've obviously been going back to many of these sites, not to retreat the same site, but to treat the next occurrence right next door. And this largely stems from the fact that our treatment areas were too small in the early years, but it also reflects, I think, that lag phase of the pathogen when we can't detect it even though we're walking beneath it. A couple of highlights from research and monitoring. One of the bigger projects over the last 2 years has been to go back to some of the treated sites, sample soil and plants on those sites and see if we can recover remorum. We're about halfway through the second year, but so far today, about 41% of the plots that we visited, we can get remorum from the soil. That's no surprise. We don't treat soil on these sites. And on about 11% of the sites, we can recover remorum from vegetation. So it's actually causing disease on those sites. But the recovery rate is very, very low. There's not much on these sites. And it's pretty clear to us that the eradication did work on many of these sites. We can't recover it. It's fairly intensive sampling. We're also doing these baited rainfall buckets where you put a little water in the bucket, you add a rhododendron leaf, and you put them out beneath trees and then track those trees through the treatment process. We've learned that you can recover spores from tanoak year-round if you get wet weather. It doesn't matter if it's summer or winter. We also find that we only get spores in those buckets when they're near infected trees, right beneath them or right next to them. But we do continue to capture spores from those trees, even though the trees have long been brown from an herbicide injection. We've had delays in our process here. We've been able to track trees for several months after they've been brown and killed by herbicide, and they still continue to produce spores. We don't capture spores on the perimeter of our treatment areas or in the forest adjacent to that. So it's not, we don't have a lot of inoculum outside of our treatment areas. We've messed around with agrifos from the air for a number of years, now treating 10-acre blocks and then doing assays to determine its effectiveness, and we use injection as a comparison here. And right now what it looks like is that we can get the agrifos into the trees by aerial application, there's no question, and we get results in terms of stem lesions, reduction in stem lesion size that's very similar to what we get with injection. So it does work in that sense. We've also got some effect on lesion growth in detached twigs. not big differences, but significant differences. Whether or not this is important in terms of disease spread, we don't know. We haven't been able to do that. And Mateo is doing some work which may help with this. So we're done with this for a while. We've got sufficient data that if we need a registration, we probably could get it. But we still have some questions about whether this kind of treatment is really effective enough to be meaningful in terms of slowing spread of the disease. So I'm going to walk you through now the spread of the disease over time. Keep in mind that these spots are greatly enlarged so that you can see them. Most of our sites are only single tree, less than a quarter acre. And as I progress through this, I'm not going to take away the sites that have been treated. I'm just going to accumulate the sites so you can get some idea of the pattern of spread. So each click is a year. So this takes us to 2005. And so the early years, we thought we were doing pretty well. Most of the new occurrences were close to the old ones. We didn't treat big enough areas. But 2005 was the first of several very wet years, and you can see we started to see some outliers. So now I go through the next few years, and you can see considerable expansion. And this is what it looked like. The yellow dots are the 2009 spots. So considerable expansion despite our efforts. Graphically, it looks like this. We've now leveled off at about 60 new infested sites per year. If you look at the number of acres represented by that, that would be this bottom line here. We're still at only 20 to 30 new acres per year of actual infested forest. And then this dotted line, the red dotted line up here, is the number of new infected trees. So we're seeing a little decrease there. That's because we're getting better at early detection. So we find the spots earlier before they have a chance to become numerous trees. That all translates into between 600 and 700 acres that should be treated each year. But we, for various reasons, we don't get all that treated. But we should, and perhaps we will. So this is the same information. I just put a 1 mile buffer around all the sites so you can get an idea of proximity. The yellow and orange ones are the old ones. These blue dots are the ones that we found so far in 2010. A lot of them are in predictable locations, but some of these outliers out here are a little disturbing. There's quite a distance between sites. That's disturbing to me because for the first survey of the year, which was done in March, that's a lot of new sites and fairly widespread. So I think we're going to be in for a challenging year as we go into the main detection season in July and August. So conceptually, this seems fairly straightforward and simple. You detect the sites as soon as you can. You draw a line around them, you get out there and you cut them and burn them, and you get all this done in the dry season before you have a chance for additional spread. But it keeps spreading, obviously. And so why is that? I don't think it's because it's surviving our treatments. We can't find it very easily on our treated sites, and the amount of inoculum being produced there is very low. But we have these delays in detection. I mentioned them with the early detection slides. There's this latency period, so the pathogen's there, we can't find it, it's producing spores. So that is a problem. And I don't know how far we can go towards fixing that. But probably more important are these treatment delays. We have these constant interruptions in the stream of funding. And so, for example, this year we spent all of our money in September. We had all sorts of new money lined up, but we didn't get to start spending that until a month ago. So we went through the whole winter with very little treatment going on. We were able to scrape together enough money to cut out the core areas of some of those infested sites, but we lost a lot of ground, and I think we'll pay for it. And unless we can fix this, this becomes a very frustrating effort. So we always want to know, is this really doing anything, what we're doing? And so we like to compare it to the California situation, and we're not pointing fingers at California, but it's a very interesting comparison, I think. So the Humboldt situation, this is data from Chris Lee, started at about the same time as our Oregon situation. And cumulatively, since that time, we're close to 16,000 acres of tan oak mortality. Now, the Oregon situation looks similar. Now, what I'm showing here is not the actual infested area, not the mortality from the disease, but a combination of the mortality from the disease plus all the trees we've killed in the name of control. So we're at about 3,000 acres of cumulative treatment plus mortality areas. So if you take the California situation and just flop it over to scale, you can see there isn't a huge difference in terms of extent of the disease. So, but there are some significant ones. So one is like an outlying site like this, and then some of the myrtle finds that they've had further north in California suggest pretty clearly that if our disease had spread at this rate, we would have had to expand our quarantine area, which would have some big impacts. But the other aspect of this is that there's been a lot of filling in California, so the difference here in terms of the amount of acres of mortality is pretty substantial. It's 13,000 acres, and that, I think, represents the benefit of this program. The last one little bit is that we finally have risk models for Oregon. Tomas Vaklovic and Ross Mittmeier and others have put together two models for us. This is the potential distribution based primarily on presence of host vegetation, climatic, and assumptions about disease spread. And then an actual distribution model, which is different from the other one. That this one takes all the information that we have about where we looked for remorm and didn't find it, plus the information about where we did find it, and comes up with an estimate of where the pathogen probably is now. And we're using these models to help identify where to put our stream base, but where to do our transect surveys and other surveys. So some areas up here that they get pretty bright color that we're doing some looking to see if it indeed is true. But this is a very useful tool for us as we go forward and assign some priorities. So as we go ahead, we're going to continue what we're doing, and it clearly is still an eradication, mainly because we don't have any other options. Given our system with Canoak, trying to get rid of inoculum is basically the best we can do. So we'll continue to do that. But as we get into a period of limited funding, we're going to have to make some choices. Our first priority will be to keep the early detection program and then treat the most important sites first, and perhaps treat them in different fashions depending on where they are, and seek out some other funding opportunities. We're right now in fairly good shape. We have some stimulus money, but that will only carry us through this year, and we're not going to achieve very much host removal with that money. It's mostly going to be spent on eradication. Good opportunity in the future for Forest Service funding, but we have the challenge of finding non-federal matching funds, which is very difficult in these economic times. But we have some strategies where landowners can step up and provide some matching funds.
Okay. Do we have time for some questions?
Alan, given the situation there, especially with your limited funding, and it kind of goes along with your treating the most epidemiological important areas first, is there any thought of basically giving up on the core center area where you had the most original detections were, and really emphasize all treatment on the periphery, given the third group of that tribe where you're going to get mostly spread out?
Yeah, that's exactly what we have to do when we have, we're running out of money. We basically put those core area sites on the back burner and go out and hit the sites on the perimeter most heavily. In fact, we'll spend disproportionately a lot of money on an outlying site, treat a very big area out there at a very big expense, and not treat a core area site until later. But we don't give up completely on those because we think the inoculum production on those sites is still important, not so much for spread on the edges, but for fill-in and for this risk of human transport out of that quarantine area, because a lot of our core area sites are in the highly populated areas, and I don't know if you know the Brookings area, but we have all these, we have rhododendron and azalea gardens and things in there, so we kind of have that responsibility as well. But at some point, that's, from what I understand, looking at other systems, when you get the most bang for your buck if you're trying to stop its expansion, is to treat those outlying areas very heavily. It's like firefighting sort of approach. You treat the spot fires. So we'll probably have to make those decisions, but we're not quite there yet. Yana.
Alan, after listening to the earlier two talks, I found myself saying, what are we doing in this country? Why are we sitting on our butts not doing anything about this? And then halfway through your talk, the sad reality of how challenging it is sinks in, and I start to cool my jets. Given what we know about this early detection problem, this latency issue, knowing what you know about Oregon and your early detection program, how early do you think you really caught it? I mean, if we've got these places where we've got streams, we know we've got a pond, we've got a minimal amount of vegetation, should we be hitting those as hard as we can with everything we've got so that we can prevent what happened in Oregon and prevent what happened in Humboldt County? Or is it just an impossible task that we'll never be able to be ahead of the curve enough?
I'm sorry, I think I'm out of time. no, the early detection thing is, if we were to go back in Oregon to the beginning, we didn't look quite as broadly as we should have in our initial delimitation surveys. So, but when we go to these sites out there, there's two kinds of spread. There's like a local intensification spread, and then there's this long distance low probability, like a splatter of paint. I think this local spread, we can delineate that stuff pretty clearly, and I'm sure we catch those spots early because we walk around there and you can't find any symptoms. And every once in a while there'll be a spot that we missed, and we'll see it blow up in a very short order of time. But that's only if you let it go for another year. The big challenge is the spotting out. How do you find those? And the earliest way you can find them is by a stream bait or an aerial survey. It's always going to be challenging. And if you're committed to a long-term effort, though, if you keep that stuff up, you keep your detection system in place, you've got your rapid response program, you're going to be doing it for a long time like they do for gypsy moth, but it's going to be worthwhile. It's going to have a big ecological benefit just by delaying the eventual cost or the eventual impact. So you've got to commit to it. I don't think we're going to be able to go out there and stomp it out and have it disappear, but I think we can keep it under control or at least greatly slow it down by attempting this rapid response eradication.
One last question.
Do you have any...
Nobody will ever hear you.
Do you know whether there was any effect on the phosphite on sporulation? Did it reduce sporulation?
We were not able to measure that. We tried that with a lot of detached assays in the lab, and that was one of the main things we tried to figure out, we couldn't do it. I think that would best be done someplace down here where they actually have the disease going on. You can treat an actual forest site, but working with detached plant material, we just couldn't get a good test of that. But that's what our thinking was: with if you could spray phosphite in advance of the leading edge of the disease, and you could prevent infection or reduce sporulation, you would really have another tool to slow it down. But as it is, we still only have this fairly crude tool.
I was thinking of maybe applying like a copper-based compound to reduce sporulation.
No, we haven't thought about that because there's limits to what we could apply from the air realistically. Thank you. Yeah.